Good morning. So last time we covered how we implement our instruction stalling and squashing operations. We learned that a big thing we wanted to look at is, well, we have these pipeline stages and each of them needs to have something to do. And we need to decide whether that's the normal thing of getting a value from the previous stage, whether we need a NOP in there because we don't have any other work for it to do, in which case we want to explicitly ask for a pipeline bubble, or if we want to keep an instruction back, which our textbook had a control signal called stall, which also have an HTLRS to do that. And we also mentioned, well, okay, we know about stalling and squashing. How do we decide when we're doing that? And generally, what we can do is we can look at things like iCode values in each stage. We're going to pass them from fetch through the pipeline. And that sort of information is going to let us make these decisions. So we can, for example, for return, we know that while return is going down the pipeline, we can't fetch new instructions. We can look at, is there a return in the decode stage pipeline registers? Is there a return in the execute stage pipeline registers to implement that logic? Then we started talking about caches. And one thing we mentioned is the motivation for having caches. That we talked about main memory. If main memory was really off the chip all the time and that's how we had to access it, it just wouldn't be efficient. It has a very high latency relative to our registers and relative to our clock cycle. So it, would make our programs run hideously slow. So our solution to that is that we're going to have these small, fast memories that are somehow going to satisfy most of our accesses and therefore give us acceptable performance, therefore have something which doesn't take a ridiculous number of clock cycles when we do a move. Now, to make this work, we have to rely on programs behaving nicely. If our programs just access random memory locations all the time, then we couldn't actually make main memory be very efficient. We'd experience that very high latency for main memory. But fortunately, we don't write programs that way. We don't write a program that just literally only accesses random addresses. At least most of us don't. And that means we have two important properties that we're going to take advantage of. So one of these is temporal locality, that if I see a value being accessed now, I can be pretty sure it's like going to be accessed again soon. Not all the time, of course, but enough of the time that it would be worth my while to store a copy of that value for later in faster storage. There's also spatial locality, that if I see a value being accessed, then the value that's stored next to it in memory is likely to be accessed again soon. Not all the time, but enough of the time that if I see that value being accessed, it's probably worth my while to store the values next to it. And these just occur naturally in programs the way we write them. We have temporal locality because we have things like local variables. We have the same pieces of data being worked on. So that just happens naturally. We have spatial locality because we have things like arrays, or we have things like code which executes one instruction, then the following instruction, and so on. Where we have, for temporal locality, we have loops. So we have all sorts of things in our programs which just make these temporal and spatial locality just happen naturally. So our next topic for today is going to be, now that we know about temporal and spatial locality, let's build what is arguably the simplest cache design we can build. But before I move on to that, questions about things we covered last time? Yes? So question 6 on the quiz was asking about which has more spatial locality. If we're accessing accesses to arrays or temporary arrays in a merge sort, or accesses to a sorted array during a binary search. And so first of all, I'll say that both of these have some spatial locality. So it's not the case that like one has none and one has all of it. And both of these have some things which don't look like great spatial locality. But in the case of a merge sort, our key merge operation, we're going to be accessing three arrays, or maybe parts of the same array if we're doing the fancy logic to do an in-place merge sort. And we're essentially going to be accessing, you know, the array, each of these arrays in order. We're going to be reading to the arrays in order to do our merge operation. And that's very good spatial locality. If I'm a cache and I see an access to here, I can guess that there's going to be an access to here soon. And same thing with here, and same thing with here. I can guess there's going to be adjacent accesses. So that's some pretty good spatial locality that our cache is going to be able to take advantage of to make it so we don't experience the high latencies of main memory. So the other option was a binary search. So for a binary search, if I have a sorted array, my binary search is going to do an access in the middle, and we'll do accesses sort of narrowing down where we're going. So I think there's some substantial spatial locality for these last accesses. But if we're searching different elements, you know, there's not going to be great spatial locality between those searches. So like if we do another search and the element is over here, you know, we'll do that. But, you know, assuming we're not searching the same thing over things that are like next to each other in the array, we're not actually going to have as good spatial locality. There's some, because at the end of our search, it's a good guess that the thing you're accessing, you know, and the second to last step is close to the thing you're accessing the last step. But it's not nearly that sort of very good spatial locality we have in that merge operation. Is that questions, follow-ups? Yeah. First of question six. Okay, so over question 4 and 5. So 4 and 5 were asking about temporal locality. So question 4 was asking iterating through a large array stored in the stack, or accesses to machine code of a small, frequently used function. So for the large array on the stack, the time between when we access any array element and we access it again is going to be relatively high compared to a small function, where the time between when we access, you know, the first instruction of the function once and the next time is going to be relatively low. So if the time between we access any part of the function versus the time between we access any one part of the array, you know, that's what we're kind of comparing, because the temporal locality rule is that if I see an access to something, I'm going to see an access to it again soon. For the array, that's probably much less true than the function. So question? Okay, so the question is, isn't the code that accesses through the array going to have good temporal locality? I agree it is. You are correct, and that is a good thing to think about, and something I should have made clearer in the question. I think that if we're comparing the two, the code is that small, frequently used function. So I think we're comparing, like, something that has good temporal locality versus something that has good temporal locality mixed with bad temporal locality. But I agree, I probably should have specified accesses only to the array to make the question clearer. And question 3, it was comparing accesses made while looking up a particular key in a hash table to accesses made while linear searching array for a particular key. So if we think of looking up a particular key in a hash table, if we're doing roughly the same number of accesses per unit time, which, I guess, maybe not. Yeah, so like we think of like number of accesses between getting a value for a key, like for the hash table, we're going to, you know, get that key by going to the right location right away, or maybe we'll follow a short chain. For the array, if our key is halfway through the array, we're going to be scanning the first half of the array every time. So the amount of time, or the amount number of accesses in between when we access, you know, any particular element of the array for the scanning is going to be higher because we have all those accesses to half the array versus the hash table. It's going to be lower because we have basically one or two accesses to other parts of the hash table, or to that part of the hash table only, probably. Yeah.
So if you were thinking about this in the context of the issue, or the reason that it should have said accesses to the machine code, you were thinking that it would be faster because using a for loop to linear search.
So the question is, if question five was about the machine code to implement this, so I think the machine code's probably similar. I think the machine code situation is probably similar. So if we're thinking of the machine code to repeatedly look up a hash table key versus repeatedly linear search an array, there's going to be more code we run for the linear search of the array, but essentially we'll be running the same instructions over and over again in both cases. Right? There's going to be a very small set of instructions to implement the lookups in both cases. So I think that the machine code temporal locality is very similar. And and the difference probably is just which takes more machine code. Okay. Questions on our locality questions? Okay, then there was a question about question one. So question one said we wanted to stall instruction C, and it specified that as a consequence of this, instruction D, which was originally in the decode stage, ended up in the decode stage in our next cycle. So that's why we had to select stall D. Because if we didn't do that, then what instruction would end up in the decode stage? It would be instruction E because it was previously in the fetch stage. Or we'd have to specify bubble D, in which case a no op would end up there, which would also not correspond to what the question's asking for. Yes?
So why did you make the decision not to say the processor wants to stall instruction C?
So the question is, why did I not say the processor wants to stall instruction C and D? So usually when we think of stalling an instruction, we're pausing one instruction, and there's going to be a bunch of consequences of that. And I would say that not being able to advance instruction D is a consequence of that. I wouldn't say we're stalling instruction D, because if all other things, because you know, if instruction C didn't exist, we would just advance instruction D. Or if we had some way of resolving instruction C's hazard, instruction D would just advance normally. So the question is, if there were a stall F option, would we pick that for this question? Yes. I didn't have one because I didn't want to imply how we were computing the next program counter value. Other questions? Yes.
It's not possible that you want, in some situation, to squash D and so on.
So it's not possible that in some situation I want to squash D
and stall C?
That is something that we might do.
Why is it implied?
But that's not what we specified happens in cycle N plus 1. If that happened, cycle N plus 1 would not list instruction D. Other questions? Yes?
So question is, would A be out of write back?
Yes, this question is written incorrectly. The question's written incorrectly. I should have not specified A and B are running a NOP. I should have specified the memory and write back stage are running a NOP. And to implement the squashing of instruction A, we could rely on the pipeline registers. Instead, we would have to have some sort of muck, some like regdesd. Yes?
My assumption was just that the PC was stalled, and then
So the question is, would stalling the PC be enough? And the answer is, it isn't, because if we leave the fetch stage alone, so if we ignore the fetch stage, the interaction between the decode and execute stage doesn't change. Like, no matter what we do to the fetch stage, unless we do something, an instruction's advancing from decode to execute. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah, and I will edit that quiz question, first quiz question, to say what I wanted to say. But yeah, I should have been more careful about also squashing that instruction and write back, which is not just going to be done with pipeline registers if we do that. Okay, so let's go to our topic of building a cache. So we're going to start with a very simple cache design known as a direct map cache. And I have a cache, I'm going to want to store some data. And I'm going to choose to have my first example have my cache store, we have 16 bytes of data here, or nope, 8 bytes of data here, because I can count. And I'm going to divide those 8 bytes into four 2-byte blocks. So why am I choosing to divide them into blocks? Because this is going to let me take advantage of spatial locality. I'm going to have things that were adjacent in memory are going to end up being adjacent in the cache. And I'm going to also divide my memory into 2-byte blocks. I'm just going to say that every pair of memory addresses is a block, and our cache is divided into blocks of the same size. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to store blocks from memory. So I'm going to choose 0, 0, and 1, 1 in this case, or 2, 2, and 3, 3. Those blocks I'm going to copy to one of the blocks of the cache. And I'm never going to do a thing where I, like, copy half of a memory block and another half of a memory block into a cache block. I'm going to always keep them together with the same sort of alignment here. So that's our cache. And I mentioned that our cache's interface is that we're going to get requests from the CPU. So let's say our request is to read from this address, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1. So if I'm the cache, I don't have enough information right now because I have a bunch of zeros in my data, and I don't know what they correspond to. So I have to make some decision about where do I look for this address in those 8 bytes to determine whether or not it's there. And the first thing I'm going to do here is I'm going to assign each of these blocks of my cache to a set of memory locations. So I'm going to give them an index, and for each memory location, there's going to be exactly one block of the cache I will look at. So in this case, I'm looking for 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1 is the address. And with this assignment scheme, that's going to be in index 1 of the cache, the second block here. And that's going to be where I store anything that's one of these every fourth block here, starting at the second one. And similarly, my index 0 will be where I store anything that's in every fourth block, starting at the first one in memory. So if I'm looking for address 0, that could be stored here. If I'm looking for address 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, that could be stored here, and so on. So when I'm storing a local copy of one of these blocks of memory, there's exactly one place I'll put it, which means when I'm looking for it, there's exactly one place I'll check. And this is known as direct mapping. So the overall mapping, we have color-coded version here, is that basically we assign, every other location, so in this case, every fourth location goes to the same block. And 4, because we have 4 blocks. And you might say, why am I deciding to assign every fourth location and not do something like, say, the first four locations go to the first block, the next four locations go to the next block, and so on. And the reason I'm doing that has to do with spatial locality. That if I think of accessing an array, I'd like to be able to keep, the whole array, or the whole first part of the array in the cache. That means I need to be able, that if the array is like stored, as these bytes, I want to be able to store all of those bytes in the cache at once. This scheme will let me do that if I decided to like have all the first four blocks of the memory go to the first block of the cache. I could only store one part of the array there. Question? So question, didn't the CPU specify which one it wants? Yes, so we're going to get to, we're going to need some extra bookkeeping to make this work. So right now, what's happening is I'm trying to read this byte, and I'm going to know it's in this index here, based on the mapping, because the real value in memory, is here. But I know that it could be stored here, but I need to figure out if it is or not. And we're going to need some extra bookkeeping to make that happen. Yes? So question, how can one block in cache store multiple blocks of memory? It can't. But over time, at some time, it might store this block I have highlighted here could store any one of those blocks at a time, those blocks of memory at a time that are blue. So sometimes it might be storing the one with address 00010, sometimes it might be storing the one with address 01010, and some of the others that aren't shown at other times. Yeah.
So is this how the mapping actually works? Like with looking out the last digit of the memory address?
So the question is, how does this correspond to our addresses? So the way I chose things means that I can look at the index and correspond it to those two bits of the memory address. And this is not just a coincidence. This is a consequence of me choosing a number of blocks of the cache that is a power of 2 and a number of bytes per block that is a power of 2. And I did that deliberately just so I could do this lookup in this way. And this is what real processors will do. And the reason why is because in hardware, using these two bits to do the lookup is very fast. And we don't want to have to instead do something like a mod operation. Yeah?
What do you mean by block?
What do I mean by block? Sorry, these here are blocks. Yes? The question is, the cache block were 4 bytes, how would the mapping change? Then we'd shift those red bars over by 1 as far as the addresses, and each row of the memory we divided the memory into would be 4 bytes instead of 2. Okay. So we have where our blocks of memory are assigned to cache. So I'm reading this byte. I say, okay, it has the bits that match to our index, which we'll call the index bits, incidentally, tell me that it's somewhere in this row here. And it could be here, but I need to figure out, wait a moment, is it actually stored there or not? The CPU is actually going to read that. Do I want to give it one of those bytes? And in this case, the answer better be no. So how do we know that? So one thing we need to know is did I actually load anything in the cache yet? So to track that, we're going to add what we'll call a valid bit. So we're going to have a piece of metadata that we'll store. So by metadata, I mean not data, but data about data, which is going to be 0 if we don't have anything stored and 1 if we do. And initially, your cache doesn't have anything stored from memory. So memory has stub values. We haven't cached them yet. We haven't stored our local copy. Okay. So in this case, we'll do that read. We'll check the valid bit. We'll find out, wait a moment, there's nothing there. So we'll go to memory, and we'll load our block. So our block is this AABB here, and the add part of it we're interested in is only the last byte, the BB. So the cache is going to store the whole block and give the last byte to the CPU. So we're going to tell the CPU, okay, got it for you, it's BB, that's what that byte is, and the cache is going to store AABB together. Now, we're still missing some information here, which might be what you're getting at, which is that if we want to look this up later, we need some extra information to know, you know, if the CPU asks for this address again, can I give it this value here, or is it actually, you know, from here? Because we have at least two places that that block could have come from. Because if you remember our mapping, you know, both of these blocks of memory could have been stored here. So to track that, I'm going to keep what we'll call a tag, which will tell me where it comes from. And the tag is going to be the bits of the address from before the index. So in this case, it's the 01 here. And if I were storing the 2233, it would be 00. So I'm just storing part of the address I didn't use yet. So not the lower bits, because that tells me where in the block to go, whether I go to the first or second byte of the block. Not the index bits, because that tells me what row to go to, but what's left over, which is, you know, what I didn't use yet, I'm going to store that so I can check later on when the CPU asks for this address, I can say, yes, it is here. Or if the CPU asks for, say, this 22, I can say, nope, don't have that. Yes?
So how do we know that we want BB rather than AA?
So the question is, how do we know that we wanted BB rather than AA? And that's because I asked for 01 here. Because remember, if you look at this diagram here, the block of memory ranges from 0 to 1 in the lower bit of the address. We know 1 is the higher part, the later part of that. Yes? The question is, why don't I have to store that lower bit in the cache? And that's because I always know I'm taking a block from memory starting at that last bit being 0 and ending at the 1 part. So there's no decision to make in the cache. I don't need to record any information about that. Other questions? Yeah.
Would your cache be 61 bits long if your memory is 64 bits?
Yeah, so for addresses were 64 bits, where our tags need, in this case, to be 61 bits long? Yeah. Other questions?
So what actually are, like, the index valid tag? Like, where, how's that represented in the code?
How is the index valid and tag running in the code? So this is part of the cache. So our processor we've built doesn't actually see the valid bits or the index bits directly. It just sends an address to the cache. So here I have a 5-bit address. If we're thinking about our processor, we're sending a 64-bit address. That's what we're seeing in our code. That's what we're seeing in our processor. This is all internal to the cache once it gets that address. Other questions? So let's do sort of another picture of how this cache would work. So we're going to get in an address. So in this case, I've written my address in binary. And I'm going to divide that address into three pieces. And I call the middle piece the index. And my cache is going to have lots of blocks, which I'll write as a bunch of rows. Those blocks will have some data and a valid bit and a tag. And we're going to use the index to decide which row of the cache to retrieve. And when we're reading, what the cache is going to do, it's going to check whether the tag matches the tag which came in. So the tag we're going to call the upper bits of the address before the index, and whether it's valid. And if that's true, we have what's known as a hit, that the value is found in the cache. If it's false, we're going to have to do some extra work to actually put a value in the cache there, and also to send a result to the CPU. Now, we also have the offset, and the offset tells us where in a block we are. So in our original example, the offset was 1 bit. You were either the first or the second byte. Here, I have 4 bytes. So my offset needs to be 2 bits, or the first, second, third, or fourth byte, depending on whether those 2 bits are 0, 1, 2, or 3. So if we're extracting 1 byte, we'll get those 4 bytes of data, and we'll select which one we want based on the offset bits of the address. And in this example, that would be B6, since that's its index 2 out of a zero-based index of that block. Yes?
So are we checking for what the correct tag and valid bit at the same time as we're checking the offset? Or are we...
So the question is, in this design, would we be checking the tag and valid bit at the same time as we're extracting the correct part of the block? Yes. Other questions? Yeah.
Does the block being 4 bytes account for spatial
location? So the question is, does the block being 4 bytes help with spatial locality? Yes. So we're going to choose our block size to be larger when we want to take more advantage of spatial locality. But a compromise we're going to be making in that is that we'll probably be able to take less advantage of temporal locality just because we'll have less slots in our cache. Other questions? Okay. So, a terminology note. So, we're going to call each row of the cache a set. And this will become important later when we're going to change how many blocks are in a row, which we aren't going to do yet, but that's going to happen later. Okay, so, yes.
Now we've only been looking at 1 block per row, right?
Yeah, right now we only have 1 block per row, yes. But I want to distinguish between also sort of the metadata and the data for row. Okay, so I mentioned that we divide up our addresses into a tag part, an index part, and an offset. So let's do this for, we have these 3 caches here. So we have our first cache with 2 byte blocks and 4 sets, 4 rows, 4 byte blocks and 2 sets, the second cache and 2 byte blocks and 8 sets. And as an exercise, let's divide this address up, which in all the caches is present and storing the value FF into our tag, index, and offset. So remember, in this example here, we had our tag was the first 2 bits. Our index was the next 3 bits, 3 bits because we had 8 rows. Our offset was the last 2 bits, 2 bits because we had 4 bytes per block. A little bit of time. Okay, so I guess to start out, I'll do our first part here. So let's start with this first cache here, which we have 2 byte blocks and 4 sets.
So on that cache, I have 2-byte blocks, which means that the last 2 bits need to be my offset bits. Or sorry, the last bit needs to be my offset bit. Why last bit? Because if I look at this cache, I need to tell that I want to use the FF here, not the EE. That's going to use 1 bit of information. Just 0, first part, 1, second part. So that means that our offset here is going to be the 1, and that's it. Why the 1? Because that's the last bit of that address. Then I have 4 sets, and that's going to determine my index, because each index goes to a particular, decides a particular row. That's the stuff just before the offset. And if I have 4 of them, that means that, you know, if I want to encode 0, 1, 2, 3, I need 2 bits to do that. So I'm going to use the next 2 bits for that. So that's our 1, 1. And then I have a tag, which is everything left over. So that's going to be 0, 0, 1. So questions on how I figure that out? Okay, so can someone tell me something about our 2-byte block 8 set cache? Any one of the 3 parts of the address for that? Yeah. Okay, so you'll need 3 bits for the index. So there's going to be 3 bits for the index because that's how much we need for 8. Okay, something else about? Yeah, back there. 2 bits for the tag. And how did you get that?
I'm reading it off the graph.
Reading it off the graph. So what do you mean by that? So. Okay, so you're saying that this looks like this must be this 111 here. And I agree it is, though how do we know it's not the, how do you know it's not that? So there's a way we can know it's not that, and that's that we know that there's has to be some bits for the offset, because we have to know where in the block we are. So the offset, in fact, has the same situation as the original, as the 2-byte block 4-set cache, that we need 1 bit to determine whether we're the first or second byte of the block. So that means our offset is the 1, our index is the 3 bits there, and the remaining 0, 0 is our tag. Yes? So the question is, I determine the number of tag bits by taking everything that's not the index or the offset? Yes. So you probably are not going to determine that first. Okay. Can someone give me answer for our last row? Someone who hasn't spoken? I guess not. Okay. So tag 001, index 1, offset 11. So the key thing here that's different from the others is the block size is different. We have 4-byte blocks instead of 2. So we need 2 bits rather than 1 bit for our offset. So 2 bits is going to be enough to determine which of those 4 bytes, 0, 1, 2, 3, those are array indexes for them. Our index, we only need 1 bit because we have 2 sets. So that's going to be labeled 0 and 1. That's 1 bit of information, and everything else is our tag. So questions about how I figure these out? Yes? So why is the tag 3 bits in our last example?
And that's because I had used, if I color here, I used this last bit for the offset. And then I used, or say these last two bits for the offset. That corresponds to our offset. Then I used the next bit for our index. So everything I didn't use yet has to be the tack. Yes?
Why is the tag 2 bits down below?
This question, why is the tag 2 bits down below where?
Like in green under the folder.
That is because I just drew this incorrectly. Just because I forgot to write leaving zeros. I'll hopefully remember to correct because I wrote some notes. Yeah.
Is it always in this order where like the offset is always the least significant grouping of bits and then the index is the next?
Okay, question is it always in this order? So the offset being the least significant bits happens because we decided that we are going to keep adjacent parts of memory together. So that has to be there. The index, we could technically move. But if we put the index anywhere but as close to the offset as possible, then if we think of like trying to access an array here, if the index wasn't the next bits, those two blocks would map to the same set, so map to the same block of the cache, and we couldn't store them both at the same time, and that would be really bad for taking advantage of locality. So we're always going to put the index just before the offset. Does that answer your question? So, right, I have the finished, written out version of this. Okay. Questions on our tag index offset split here? Okay, so I've shown us figuring out the tag index offset by, like, looking at the cache arrangement. That is a 100% valid way of doing it. Our textbook has a whole bunch of formulas. That is also a valid way of doing it. But I'd like you to know kind of where those formulas come from and not just blindly chug and plug in formulas and then not realize why it doesn't make sense for one case or another. Okay, so let's do a little exercise. So we'll start with the first part here. So let's say I have a cache that's direct mapped. We have 64 blocks and 128 sets. And the question is, how many tag index offset? How do we split this up, our 32-bit addresses into tag index offset bits? How many of each of there are there? So, and we can do this with formulas. We want but we have the information here. So can someone get me started on how would I figure out offset bits? Yeah, back there. So I need to figure out how much data is inside each block. And fortunately, I am told that right here. Okay, what do I do with that? So shouldn't there be two what?
Like two things inside each block. So offset is one.
Okay, so you're saying aren't there two things inside each block because it's 32-bit addresses? And no. So our addresses address a single byte. It happens that they're 32-bit long, but if you remember the address size here, these addresses were 6 bits. Like the address size is not relevant yet. It will be later. So the question is, how many things are stored inside our 64-byte block? And the answer is going to be 64, because our addresses, each address is a single byte. So given that, how many offset bits do we need? Someone said, just yell out, six. So six, which was two to the, and that's 2 to the 6 bytes is why we do that. So 2 to the 6 bytes, so we have 6 offset bits. And notice I just needed the 64-bit blocks. And our textbook's formulas, note this is saying that our block size is equal to 2 to the number of offset bits. So we could have used this formula to figure that out and, you know, done some algebra and said, oh, we take log base 2 of the block size, then we got the number of offset bits. And that would be that same logic. So how about index bits? So what number here is important for index bits? Second one, that would be this one. And that's the number of sets, the number of rows, because the index bits determine which row we go to. So we have 128 sets, and that's going to be 2 to the 7 sets. So that means we're going to have 7 index bits. Which again is in this formula, the number of sets is 2 to the number of index bits. And how big is the tag? The tag is everything left over. So the tag is going to be 32 minus 7 plus 6 bits. Which is should be 19 if I can do math on the fly. So questions on how I figured that out? Okay, so now that we know how our index and offset bits work, let's go to the other question. So if I have a block from address 0x1037, what bytes are also part of that block? Let's give you a minute and check with the neighbors. I would probably write things down for this question. Question?
Does the block have to start at an even number?
So the question is, does the block have to start at an even number? More than that, the block needs to start at an offset bits of 0.
Okay. So you couldn't just, like, put the first thing in your first block.
Yes. So just like in our original example here, right, we had to, like, start with 2-2. Because that's how we divided up memory. And that's going to be the same here. We're going to have to start at one of those 64-byte blocks at something which is a multiple of 64 address. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, a bunch of people.
Okay, who's probably more people. Okay, so as people are still working, let's, I guess I'll start my logic. So one thing that's really handy to do is split up, is write our address in binary. So I can just do that byte by byte here. So nibble by nibble. So I start with 7, that's 0111 in binary. 3 is 0011 in binary. So those are my last 80 bits. Which I like having so I can like easily find the offset, for example. Something to note that often gets people here is that it's a 32-bit address. I didn't write the leading zeros because I don't like always write the leading zeros of numbers, but there's a bunch of leading zeros that I didn't write. So don't start from the beginning unless you know where the first digit actually is, and there's a bunch of leading zeros that aren't written. And do people still want more time for I see a few people. Let's start with who says A is most likely correct. We have thinks B, C, D. Okay, so it looks like most people have found what I think is the correct answer, which is that A through C, but not D, are in the same block. So how would you figure this out? So if I split up the address here, I know the last 6 bits are my offset. And if we think of what's going to be in the same block, well, it's going to be a contiguous range which only differs in the offset. The index has to be the same because it has to be in the same row of the cache. And the tag has to be the same because it has to be able to be stored together. Alternately, if we looked at our diagram here, right, it's something which differs in our offset bits. In this case, we had 1. In the other case, we have 6. Where the offsets start at 0 at the beginning of the block and go to all 1s at the end of the block. And if we apply that to this here, well, what's this address if we put all zeros in our index bits? Well, that's going to be a bunch of zeros there. Sorry, zeros in our offset bits. That's a bunch of zeros there. So this block is going to be 0x1000 through what if we have all 1s in here? And all 1s in here would be 3F, if I read that back. So our block contains bytes from addresses 1000 hex to 103F hex. So I can just say which of these are in between there,
and that's the first three. But D, that's in the next block, and it has a different index, so it's going to be stored in the next row of the cache. And I know it has a different index because if I write out the address for that, it's going to end in 01000001. That's the last 8 bits of 1041 as an address. And the index bits of it start at this 01 here. So it has index 1 instead of index 0. Or 1 something. So questions about how I figured this out? Yeah. Where did the 3F come from? 3F is if I put 1s in the last 6 bits of this address. So this stays a 3 because that's 1, 1. This 7 becomes 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, which is F. Yes? So if I replace the leading, if I replace the first part of the address with something else, would it be part of the same block or not? It would not be part of the same block. And if I replace the 1 with a 3, I believe that changes the, because the 1 with 3, I think that, yeah, only, it happens to only change the tag. So it would be something else that would be stored in the same row. So in our original example, it would be like, it would be like the difference between these two highlighted blocks. Other questions? Yeah. Question is, yeah, the index is which block and cache it goes into, which row we select here in this diagram. The tag is whether it's from the right part of memory given that. So the tag just tells us, is it the first set of blocks, the second set of blocks, and so on. And the offset tells us where in the blocks data we went to look. Okay, so now that we have some idea about cache operation, let's go through an example access pattern here. So here I have a 2-byte block with 4 sets. So if I want to figure out how does this cache behave, first thing I need to do is divide my addresses to index and offset bits. So I'm going to have a tag, index and offset. My offset is 1 bit because I have 2-byte blocks. My index is 2 bits because I have 4 sets. And I can see I need 2 bits to number them in binary. And I'm going to go through this and figure out whether I have hits or misses. So let's say we're first accessing address 0. So to deal with this, I'm going to look at index 0. I'm going to say, is the value there? The valid bit 0? So the answer is no. So this is going to be a miss. And a consequence of that miss is that we're going to bring in the block because we assume we have temporal locality. We assume we're going to access address 0 later. And I have to bring in the whole block that contains address 0, which is going to be addresses 0 and 1. So I'm going to write that out. I'm going to store the tag and mark it as valid. Then I have my next access where I had spatial locality, and I actually took advantage of it. So that's going to be a hit. I'm going to say this is index 0, 0. So I look in this row. Then I say, let's see if it's valid. It is. Let's see if the tag matches. It's 000 versus 000. It matches. It's a hit. So I'm going to retrieve the byte, the second part of the block, and send that to the CPU. Then I have an access to address 63 that goes to index 1. It's not there, but I'm going to fill it in after I record a miss and send what I get from the memory to the CPU. Then I have an access to address 6.1. So again, I split up the address into my tag and index. So I have an index of 0.0. So I'm going to look here. I'm going to say it's valid. Okay. So let's keep going. Its tag is 0.1100. Does that match 0.0000? No. So it's going to be a miss. And a consequence of that miss is I'm going to replace what was previously there in the cache with the new thing. Why am I going to do that? Because of temporal locality. I assume that it's more likely I will access something address 6.1 again than I'll address 6.0.0.0 again, or 0.1, because I've accessed it more recently. In this case, if you look ahead, that assumption is wrong. But that's the assumption I'm making because that's what temporal locality tells me. Yeah?
So, does the valid bit ever come in handy?
So, question, if the cache is full, isn't the valid bit not useful anymore? And yes. So, in practice, we might have other reasons to remove stuff from the cache in addition to dealing with just booting up the cache, which is why we need to track a valid bit. Other questions? Yeah.
We'll never change valid bit from 1 to 0.
So question is, we'll never change valid bit from 1 to 0. We will not see scenarios where you change the valid bit from 1 to 0. They exist in a more complete coverage of caches because of things like multiple cores or multiple caches working with each other. Or because of the operating system asking the processor to please empty the cache for some reason. Okay.
So if you missed the cache, then you'd have to go to main memory to get the value?
This question is, every time there's a miss here, we're going to main memory to get a value? Yes, we're going to main memory or the next level of cache to get a value for every one of those misses. So we'd ideally like not to have so many. Other questions? Okay, so then our next access here is to, it has index 0.1. I look at 0.1, I check my tag, 0.1.1.0, it matches, so I'm going to have a hit. And I'm going to be able to retrieve the value from memory at 6.2. I didn't access it before, but I accessed 6.3, it's in the same block, so I got some advantage from spatial locality. Then I access address 0.0 again, and even though I accessed it before, it's no longer in the cache because I replaced it. So when I look it up, I see index 0.0, it's valid, but the tag doesn't match, it's going to be a miss. I'm going to put back address 0.0 in there, because I'm going to assume that even though it was wrong last time, it's going to be right this time, that I'm going to access this most recently accessed thing again sooner than the less recently accessed thing. Then I have an access to address 1.0 here. So I look up 1.0. I find out that previously it wasn't valid, so I'm going to load it into the cache. Then I'm going to load the whole block, which is going to be addresses 6.4 and 6.5. So questions on how I figured out how this access pattern works, how you would do this yourself? Yes. Is the first thing I check the valid? Yes. Because if the valid bit isn't set, everything else is junk. So in practice, we might, like in this diagram, we might like kind of check the valid bit in parallel with everything else, but the effect should be the same. Other questions? Okay, so in that case, let's do this exercise. So I have a different cache here, the same access pattern, different cache. So I have 4 byte blocks and 4 sets. So I have 4-byte blocks. How many offset bits do I have? Two. So I'm going to have 2 offset bits. So this is 2 to the 2-byte blocks. So that implies 2 offset bits. And I have 4 sets, which means I have 2 index bits. So that's how I divide up my addresses. So given that, the exercise, which of these axes are going to be hits? And assume everything's initially invalid, even though I didn't write that down. So I can actually scribble over this slide. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, a couple. Okay, who still would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks our first axis is a hit? Our second axis is a hit. So let's people say that, and okay. Our third axis is a hit. Okay, our fourth axis is a hit. Our fifth axis is a hit. Our sixth axis is a hit. Okay, and our last axis is a hit. Okay, so we have agreement with, this is what I agree with. So the logic here is we load address 00. This is going to load 00 through 03, because that's the block. we then load 6.3. That's going to load 6.0 through 6.3 because that's the block. This is the last byte of the block because it has offset bits of 0.1. So we have hits there. Then when we try to access 0.0 again, well, it mapped to index 0. So when we loaded 6.0 through 6.3, we overwrote 0.0 through 0.3, which is why this is a miss. And our last access is a miss because we never even access anything else in the same index. Questions about this example? Okay, so we seem pretty comfortable with that. So I'd like to go back to something which came up on our first example, which is we had sort of what we know as a conflict miss, that we had cases where we accessed something where we had good temporal locality. We were accessing something again, but it was a miss because we had something else that mapped to the same index. And this seems bad because if we look at our cache, we didn't actually use the whole thing. Right? We have some blocks of our cache which weren't storing anything, and wouldn't it be nice if we could somehow be a little smarter about how we decide what indexes to use? And we had a more extreme version of this come up in this example here, where we weren't, in fact, using most of this cache. But because things happened to have the same index bits, we got these high rate of misses. And this sort of thing does happen on occasion on real programs, because if you have like two different regions of memory, the index bits might just coincidentally be the same. And this is a problem for this direct map cache design. And there's going to be a solution that we're going to talk in more detail about next time, which is that we're going to add what we'll call associativity, that rather than having one block per set, per row, we'll have two or more. And we'll call each of these a set, and we'll call each of the columns a way. So this is called a two-way set associative cache. Set associative because our sets are associations, and two ways because we have two columns. And our same sort of formulas apply as before, that we have in this case 2-byte blocks. So we have 2 to the 1 bytes is one offset bit, and two sets, two rows, that's going to be one index bit. Which means that if we think of our access pattern here, we're going to have one offset bit and one index bit, not two, because we only have two rows now. And we can do our same access pattern again. So we access 0, 0, we get a miss. We load in 0, 0 and 0, 1 in one of the two ways. I just chose the first one arbitrarily. Then I access 6.3, it goes, in this case, to a different index because of how the index and offset bits worked out. And then I access 6.1, and that previously was something where we would get rid of 0.0. Now we don't anymore, we have a second slot for it. And I access 6.2, that's a hit again. And now, when I access 0.0, I have two places to look, and how do I tell which one is right? So how am I going to know if I'm accessing address 0 whether I want to go to the first block or the second block? Yeah. The tag. The tag's going to tell me. So I store the tag earlier on to figure out whether I found the right block in when I had only had one choice. Now I have two choices, but it'll still tell me if I found the right block. So I'm going to have a hit. I'm going to go to this block of the two choices. And then we're going to do a problem we're going to talk about next time, which is that, wait a moment, I can still run out of blocks. Now I have a choice to make. How do I make that choice? Where do I put this 6.4? And we'll get to that next time, along with the operation of our associative caches.